The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with chess players, personalities, authors, and adult improvers about their lives, their careers, and about chess improvement. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have another strong young player and trainer joining us this week, and author, of course. He has written two opening books with Thinkers Publishing, The Modernized Ready and The Modernized Dutch Defense. He has also recently done an online course for Chess 24 on the London system. So we're going to talk some openings. He's also worked as a trainer on the French national team at Olympiads, worked with French world youth teams. And in August, he's coming off a good result. In August, he tied for first in the Accession Open section at the French Championship, which our guest was just telling me means he'll get to play in the closed French Championship next year. So without further ado, we have a lot to discuss. Adrien de Muth, I should say Grandmaster Adrien de Muth, thank you for joining the show.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. So first of all, congrats on, I know it's been a couple months, but I mean, it's this result in the French Open tournament is quite a good one, and a big, I would imagine, result for your career with the fact that you get to play in the French Closed Championship next year. So could you tell us a little bit about how that tournament went for you?
Yeah, actually, it's quite a difficult tournament because it's for players with more than 2,200 ELO, so they are around maybe 60 players, and you need to fight on every game because a short draw in the first round is really bad. So you need to start well. I managed to do it more or less. So I started with 3.5 out of 4. And then it was a bit strange because there were a lot of draws. So finally we went to finish with 4 players tied for first place. And we had only 6.5 out of 9. I think it was the first time in the history of this tournament that you can qualify with so only 6.5 points. Normally you qualify with at least 1 point more. So, and I finished second, and there were 2 places. So it's good for me for next year.
Yeah, I mean, that must have been a good feeling. And you were saying it, there was no tiebreak, right? So once you tie, it comes down to sort of the luck of the draw. How do you feel about systems like that?
Yeah, actually, it's really strange because one of the players was pretty sure to be qualified after the last round, but there was this last game that was decisive for the second place. And it's like I had one of my opponents who needed to make a draw, and he was worse. And if he had lost, I would have been third. So it's like you can't do anything about it. Finally, the game ended in a threefold repetition where he was still worse. So it's quite lucky because the opponent didn't notice it. It was a repetition. That's how I qualified, actually.
So did you hang out behind the board of that game and like make scary looks at the guy that you needed to draw?
No, actually, I was not around.
Okay.
I was just
good that you took the high road. Yeah, but I don't know. My personal opinion, I've said this on the show, and sometimes I go on little Twitter rants about it. I really think there should be tiebreaks when there are prizes that are that high stakes. What's your opinion?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the best option because otherwise, you can always keep a bad feeling if it turns out badly for you. So this time I was happy, but of course I would have preferred just to play some games and not being waiting for some stupid last game to finish.
Yeah. So why do you think so many tournaments? I feel like there's a pretty clear consensus. I know they, your friend and colleague, Romain Edouard, editor at Thinkers Publishing, he in the Isle of Man tournament, which obviously there was a huge tie going into the last round. And I know he said something on Twitter about he was a little disappointed that there was no tiebreak. So do you feel like there's a consensus amongst, you know, top level players, the grandmasters like yourself, about whether or not there should be tiebreaks?
I think most players think that a real tiebreak is the best way, because sometimes the difference between first and second is so important. I mean, for the candidate, it shouldn't be decided in the difference of maybe a few low pawns points you have with your opponent. So, yeah, I mean, it's a too big difference for something that is almost nothing. So I'm pretty sure most players, most grandmasters think there should be some decisive tiebreak games.
Yeah, organizers take note. And I guess, of course, one of the reasons they do it, and I think that this makes more sense sort of at tournaments that are not elite tournaments, is it's hard to schedule an extra day. It's a lot to ask players to change their flights, but I feel like, especially at the highest levels, the prizes are high enough where they should do that. But do you know of any other reason why it's done the way it's done, other than just tradition?
For the candidates, I have no idea. I was surprised that there was no game in Isle of Man to decide who was qualified. I know in France for the French championships, they decided the title in tiebreak this year, and this is the same day as the last round, so the players are simply exhausted and the games are generally not so good. So I'm not really sure it's a better idea to play it the same day. I think I agree with you. You should take one extra day to do a well-organized tiebreak system. But if it's the same day just before the prize giving ceremony, then it makes only little sense to me. Yes, you're simply too exhausted after the last.
Yeah, round. Yeah. Of course, that wouldn't be a great way to do it. Definitely, people need a rest day and a day to do a bit of prep and stuff like that. But
yeah, but it's pretty clear that in most tournaments, it's quite hard to schedule another day. But of course, for something like the Isle of Man tournament, they should have.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. With something that. Yep. That important. So having gotten this prestigious award and this great opportunity to play in the closed championship, does that change your approach to chess as a professional who does training and playing as well? Are you going to be trying to compete more based on that, or you just kind of have to live your life?
I'm not so sure yet. I still have something like 10 months to work, but no, recently I was more focusing on teaching chess and writing some books, so I think it will help me get back to work for myself and try to be competitive at the championship. So I think it will force me to work for myself. If I want to do something good, then I need to prepare, otherwise it's just too difficult.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you've got Laurent Freycinet always plays, and I don't know, MVL may or may not make an appearance, and so many strong players in France. And you guys seem like you have, in France, it's like there's a deep bench, too. There's a lot of grandmasters in France.
Yeah, there are 50 grandmasters, I think, and 10 are more than 2,600.
Wow.
So, of course, it's quite hard to get to the first closed tournament with 10 players. MVL is not playing anymore. I think it's quite normal. He has other priorities, but there are other strong opponents to play there. So.
So what do you? I know that, and we'll definitely get to this. But you partially grew up in Tahiti, but are now based in France and have spent many years in France. So to what do you attribute the success of French players at the top levels?
I think maybe it's because in the 80s there were some Soviet players that came to France. So I think about Boris Spassky, about maybe Anatoly Weiser, who was several times senior world champion. And these players, these strong players and grandmasters, they shared their knowledge with the players in France, and at the time where France was really not a chess a big chess nation, we started to have some strong grandmaster first from the Soviet Union, and then of course some players like Olivier René. I think he was the first grandmaster in France, and then many others followed. And yeah. And then it was easier.
And are there a lot of chess school programs, or is it done more at the club level? What's the general interest level of chess, like on a broader base?
It's not so clear because it's not the same in every part of France. In some parts, you can have chess in schools. So, for example, in Corsica Island, they are doing some even championships inside the island among the different schools, and they have more than 3,000 competitors. Wow. In the same place. And so they have chess as part of school, as well as for mathematics and other things. So it's exactly the same. They do maybe 1 or 2 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
But in most other parts, it's like there is no chess school, there is no chess in school, and so it's only in clubs mainly. And yeah, I think they sometimes try to go in school, but it's during lunch or after school. It's not really as the other things you do in school.
Okay, yeah. So yeah. Reasonably popular, but has room to grow as well, it sounds like.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And obviously, right. I know it seems like French players are always rooting hard for MVL up top. So obviously, if he could ever, if he could win the World Championship or even play in the World Championship, although, of course, we've got to take care of the candidates first. It seems like that could be a big boost for French chess.
Yeah, for sure it could be. I think what Magnus did in Norway was a big improvement for chess. So it probably could be the same in France. I mean, you will, if you talk about chess in television all the time and in the newspapers, then of course it's easier to have children to do it in schools. And to go to clubs, it's more appealing.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, Adrian, let's talk about your openings books. So you've books and course, I should say. So you've written three of them: the London System, the Ready, and the Dutch. I checked out the intro video of the London System on Chess24, and I read some of your Ready book. I did not get a chance to take a look at the Dutch. I've never been a Dutch player, so I have to admit I was. That one wasn't my highest priority, although I was curious, of course. But one thing I noticed about those choices is it seems like you're focusing on sort of, especially in the case of the Ready and the Dutch, sort of less popular openings. And I also checked out your database a little bit and checked out your games. And I know that you dabble in these openings, but they're certainly not the only thing you play. So that made me wonder how you decide which openings to tackle.
Quite difficult to say because I have always played many openings. I've been interested in like the with the d4 systems mainly. Recently, I tried to play e4, but it's quite difficult. I'm having some hard times. Okay, at some point I was a bit disappointed with my play after d4, so I started to play less common openings, starting with knight f3. And at some point I was getting very good results with it. it was like, for me, it was like very close to the D4 systems, but at the same time, players with black were clearly knowing less on these openings. Like all the transpositions and even the theory on the reties that has nothing to do with systems with D4. Mm-hmm. It was like my opponents were not so aware of what they should do, and clearly less compared to D4. And it was a bit the same as like I was playing sometimes big openings like the Sicilian and one E4, E5, the main lines, but more or less my results were better when I was playing side lines. So my approach ever since was to work deeply on the side lines and to always have more knowledge than my opponent on these systems.
And have you found this to be true against players all the way up to the Grandmaster level, or is this, or do you use the sidelines more as a weapon against sort of club level, you know, 2200 and below type players?
No, actually, in my games, I play the same openings almost against every type of opponent. Mm-hmm. For example, even when I had to play Anon, Vichy Anon with black.
Oh yeah, that's in my notes, that game.
this is really typical because I was like, if I play a main system, it will probably be clearly better prepared than me. So what's the point in playing a main line if I know I don't even have an edge in the opening? I will simply be suffering. So I just went for a sideline in the Steinitz Spanish.
Deferred, right, yeah.
Yeah. And okay, he was, not, of course, he doesn't meet this system very often in the high-level games. So at least I got a decent game and where he was not knowing things better than me. So at least maybe he was understanding them better, but at least I had some knowledge I could use, and it was useful for the game. So I always played also sidelines against stronger players than me, and
yeah,
it worked quite decently.
Yeah, listeners, let's not bury the lead. Adrian won that game against Anand. So just an incredible result. I always like to what players of your strength, when I'm preparing for an interview, I like to call out my database and then sort of sort by highest ELO and see what happened. So obviously in this case, it kind of jumped off the page. The first one I see is, oh, you beat Anand with black. Nice.
Clearly my main game.
Yeah, well, it doesn't get much better than that. So
actually, I was a bit sad. It's true. The night after the game, because I was like, probably in my life, I won't beat a stronger opponent or a more famous one.
Yeah.
So it was like, I did it, but then what's next?
I think you'll be okay, but yeah, you beat the world champion. There's no universe. Not the sitting world champion, but former world champion. There's no universe champion. So yeah, it doesn't get much higher. So could you, you kind of, as you said, you got a playable opening, you did like a kingside attack, and then it was a complicated game, and then it just double-edged, and then he basically made the last mistake, and you won. So could you take us through the emotions of the game a little bit, like at the moment where you thought, wait, I might actually win this game?
Actually, it was very strange, because, the game was really complicated. I was the first one to be in sight note. I think the last move he had about 10 minutes and I had maybe 1 or 2 minutes. It was a really double-edged game where I had pawns on the queen side, he had pawns on the king side. Very strange position. And at the end, he blundered, I think in move 39 or 40. So it was in Gibraltar, so I get my 50 minutes after move 40. And I'm still not sure I'm winning because it just happened. So he did a mistake, but it's quite a forcing line.
Yeah, so, transition to an end game, right?
Yeah, I was trying to calculate, and at some point I was like, maybe I missed something, but it's like he can't escape. And at some point he just played two moves, two logical moves, and he resigned.
Yeah.
So it was really fast, actually.
You guys both in time trouble? You mentioned you got more time, so I was just curious.
No, when he blundered, he had about 10 minutes.
Okay. But you were a little short on time?
Yes, I think he was trying to put some pressure on,
right, play
on
the
my
clock.
Moves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So even at the level of Anand, I mean, it's always a tricky question of when your opponent's in time trouble, how do you approach it?
Yeah, probably because he normally calculates clearly faster than me. He was thinking that he shouldn't let me any time to calculate on his moves. So he played very, very, very fast.
Okay. But so when you traded queens, you weren't immediately sure that you were winning.
I thought it was quite maybe dubious, but my feeling was maybe I just missed something.
Yeah, of course.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe he will catch my A pawn and I won't win, and maybe he will promote first. It was a bit early to say that I was sure it was a bad thing, but it seemed strange. But actually, he missed an important move. A strange king move, and after that it was more or less all over. So
yeah, and I'll link to the game for listeners, and there's a couple YouTube videos up of people analyzing the game if you'd like to check it out that way. But yeah, definitely a feather in your cap. So what did it feel like afterwards? Were you able to prepare for the next round? Were you feeling like you were riding high? How did you go on with the tournament?
I got so many messages after the game that it was a bit of a distraction. The day after, no, actually first, my girlfriend arrived by surprise this night, so she had planned it. So right after the game, she jumped at me, and then a few seconds after, I had to go to the interview. So, of course, it was a bit euphorizing, but the next day I had to play against David...
Navarro,
Rapport?
Right? Yeah.
No, Rapport.
Oh, sorry.
Not David.
Sorry, say the name again.
Richard Rapport.
Ah, okay, go ahead.
And this was pretty interesting game, but finally I lost, and then I had to get back playing player around 24, and it was like the best part of the tournament was gone. So,
and is your girlfriend a chess player?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. So
she was not playing, but she arrived by surprise this night. Pure luck.
Right. Well, the good thing about beating a world champion is even if your girlfriend's not a chess player, she can understand the magnitude.
No, she knew, but actually when she jumped at me, she was not sure I had won. It was not because there was a delay on the transmission, so it was like, what did you do?
She's just happy to see you, right? That's a great story. Thank you for sharing that. And we'll get back to the openings in a second, but what are your other... I mean, I assume that's one of your favorite memories as a chess player, but do you have others that you look back on similarly fondly?
Yeah, I have another game. When I did my second Grandmaster norm, I was playing in Andorra Open. I was playing in the middle of the tournament. I think it was round five, probably. I was playing against the super strong Julio Grandazuniga,
mm-hmm.
Peruvian player.
Yeah, legend.
With black as well. And actually, the game is pretty similar to Anand's game. It's like I'm not so sure what's going on, and suddenly it's pretty complicated, and suddenly I happy to be winning. And more or less the same when he decided to just shake hands and resign. I was like, Didi offer draw?
Right.
Or did he simply resign? I was not so sure because I felt like I had to be winning, but it seems like an early way to resign.
Huh. That's a funny feeling. I think a lot of chess players have had that, although usually for most of us, not against players of that caliber. But
yeah, because he doesn't simply stop clocks. He just share hands. So I don't know. It was like, did he think I offered the draw? Or
That's
I was not so sure. So I waited for him to sign the copy and to score a 0-run. And
right.
No, I was sure.
That's great. Cool. Okay, well, Adrian, thanks for sharing those stories. Now, bringing it back to the opening. So one question I had is with the London system and the Ready, obviously, they're not stylistically all that similar, but they're both similar in that they're less popular ways to play with white. They're kind of system openings. I was curious, I had two related questions, some sort of looking at it from my perspective, but I think from a lot of sort of club players' perspective, if you have a sense of if one of those openings is more testing, and also if one of them is more work than the other, if one were to try to adopt one of these openings, either as a surprise weapon or as their main repertoire.
I think the two openings, the Ready and the Dutch,
The London, starting with the Ready and the
London. Sorry. I think they are quite different because in the Ready opening you want probably a slow system where you're trying to get a comfortable middle game, and then you want to simply outplay your opponent mainly in the center, while the basic idea in the London system is, to my eyes, it is to get an attack on the king side, to get something like bringing a knight in the center and then bring the queen to f3 and h3 and trying to mate your opponent. So the two openings doesn't follow the same rules, I think. And also in the Ready opening, it's clearly also more complicated to play because you can have many kinds of setups, of different setups. You don't necessarily push the same pawns in the center. Maybe you don't even push any pawn, and it depends. While in the London, it's quite, okay, the first moves are quite obvious. You will more or less always play the same. So this is... yeah, definitely different. In the London, you want to play the same, and then you generally have a couple of different plans, but you can play the London with less knowledge, I think, than the Ready.
Oh,
sure.
Interesting. Because, a couple things about the Ready. I was reading the book on forward chess. It's obviously a great way to study opening books, and I was... interested. I mean, first of all, I was glad to see that you don't concede the center entirely, which is you know, sometimes a concern with the Ready.
This was my main goal, actually. Choose lines where black couldn't get two pawns in the center. Otherwise, I think it's just too much.
Yeah.
You can allow one pawn, like the d5 or the c5 pawn, but not both of them.
Yeah, I think that's important as a selling point for listeners. I mean, it's just, otherwise it just seems to concede too much.
Yes.
So I was glad to see that, but I was surprised by the amount of theory. I guess I'm historically more of an E4 player, so I'm not as well versed to begin with in all of the transpositions that you get into. But yeah, I mean, there are so many little subtleties that I can see I can see what you mean about it being more work.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably because when you play something like knight f3, intending a slow plan like g3 or maybe b3, that means that black can do many, many systems. He can push any pawns he wants. He can even play the same as you. And you don't really decide the game as it happens after e4 or d4. it's clearly different. You are not intending to grab the center, so black clearly has free hands, and you as well. So I think necessarily it means that there should be probably at least as much theory as after e4 or d4. I think there is only less because it's less played. So we don't think it's so important. But basically, I think there are probably as many nines as in the other first moves.
Yeah, and I like that in the book you seem to be reasonably objective. Like, there are positions where you might say it's equal, but I think white side is easier to play or something like that. I'm always glad to see when people aren't just like pretending that the side they advocate is just much better in every position.
Yeah, no, there is even a line, I think, in the King's Indian where I finish the line and I say, okay, it's a perpetual and you don't have better, but it was a pretty forcing line. And I was like just saying, okay, maybe if your opponent knows everything, maybe you have to agree to a draw here. But first, probably he won't remember anything, and he will just play something very different. And also, to compensate, I'll also provide another way to play the opening. But yeah, sometimes I think that in theory, after e4, after d4, after knight e3, black always have a way to keep an equal position. And actually, I have a story about that, because I was talking about theory with the grandmaster Yossif Dorfman, living in France. And at some point after a game that we drew, we talk about chess, and he tells me, you know, Adrian, today every opening is equal. You take even the worst opening, the Benoni. Even the Benoni.
Benoni, oh no, that's fired.
Even the Benoni is equal. So, yeah, I was like, with the Reti, I can't promise you an advantage in the opening. Otherwise, I'm just lying, of course. So there has to be a line where black is okay. I'm pretty sure of it.
I mean, Fabiano has trotted out the Benoni at the top level once or twice, so...
But I'm pretty sure Yossif is right. I think probably the Benoni is equal, but the thing is, there are probably openings where you need to be more precise than others.
Yeah, for sure.
Probably the Dutch and the Benoni are openings where you need to be very precise to keep the balance.
Yeah. So speaking of that, why the Dutch? Why did you decide that this was another project you'd like to undertake?
First, because there is a common point with the Reti. It is that there are only a few good books on these openings, especially the Reti. No real books that were providing a full repertoire for white. I mean, I had one providing a repertoire after 1d5, but that's it, not against the other moves. And the Dutch, I had some books. I know there are some good books, but sometimes the lines were not anymore very strong because of computers. Maybe some lines were simply refuted. So I felt like the theory on the Dutch needed some improvement, and yeah, I was quite happy to try to do it. And I was playing the Dutch myself, so it was quite logical choice, I think.
That makes sense. And how have your results been with the Dutch?
Since the book was published, you mean?
Well, just generally.
Generally, it was okay. Actually, strangely enough, I had many draws, which is not so logical with this opening, but I played it against player from 2300 to 27, and I won a few games. I drew plenty of them, but I think I only lost one recently.
Wow, so you're holding your own for sure.
More or less. It was quite a bad loss against Kledura in the European Championship, but okay.
Happens.
The opponent is tough and the line was pretty critical, so I just completely lost the track of the game.
Okay. And the Dutch, I feel like it's got a small but loyal fan base amongst chess players. Like it's, you know, it's not as popular, but the people who like it will really go to the mat for it. But I was obviously, especially at the top level, you don't see it super often. So from your perspective, is there one line against it that makes it less appealing for top players, or is it more just that it's that you have to be so precise throughout?
Probably it's a bit both, but I think there are a couple of lines in the main line where white, for example, there is this line where white wants to crush black. He plays something with c4, knight c3, and then an early h4.
Mm-hmm. Harry,
trying to destroy the pawn on g6. And so I think some players are quite afraid of this kind of system. I mean, even in top level. But, okay, still we see some games of Carlsen sometimes, of Caruana. I think they have more been playing the Stonewall system,
mm-hmm.
which is a bit different than what I'm offering. But still, actually, I more or less discovered the Leningrad Dutch with black when I saw some games of Gatakamski that he played in the US, I think, in 2013. And he won a couple of games against Gelfand and Nakamura. And it all seemed so simple for him. So at that point, it was like white had no clue how to handle Gata's play. So, yeah, it started to be quite appealing to me. And I think in 2014, 1 year later, I started to play it myself.
Okay. Well, it's good. I mean, like I said, I know the Dutch fans are glad to have Grandmasters still wading into the waters of the Dutch and finding ways to make it playable, because it's certainly, I mean, it appeals to dynamic players who you know, don't want to be playing the Queen's Gambit declined and stuff like that. So,
yeah, for sure. It's for players that want to something more dynamic and a bit clearly different than other openings.
Cool.
Clearly double-edged.
And do you have another project in the works regarding openings?
I'm talking about that with Romain Edouard, but it's not so clear yet. Maybe something with black against e4. As I did something for white. I did something for black against d4 and knight f3 and c4. So it's quite logical to do it for black against e4, but it's not so sure yet.
Yeah, that makes sense. And do you consider yourself having, I mean, especially when I'm thinking of your work with the Olympiad, the French national teams, do you consider yourself sort of an opening specialist, or has that just sort of, that's, you know, as a professional, that's what the demand, that's what the market wants. So that's what you give.
Yeah, the demand is clearly, nowadays, I think most people, they just want to know a lot about theory, and it's a bit sad, but they take less care about other part of chess, such as strategy and even tactics and the end games, of course. I think at every level, people are using too much theory, and they are doing too much theory in their work. So the demand is in theory, but also I think I'm like every other player. I also prefer to work on theory. So
yeah,
I'm more or less I specialized in this area, and yeah, I think it's my main weapon. It's my
knowledge.
So.
Yeah, and at your level, it makes sense to spend a lot of time on openings. I mean, it's you know, the other aspects of your game are obviously pretty good.
Yeah,
so
it's clearly the main thing because also it's more helpful because you know that at some point you will be able to use it. Oh, maybe not every line, but if you work on a full repertoire, you know that at every game you will be able to use it. While when you study maybe end games, it's a bit disappointed because maybe you study something and you don't play this in the next 5 years,
right.
And then when it comes up, then you forgot what you what you worked on. So it's like you a waste of time. But at least with the opening, you're pretty sure that in the next tournament you will be able to use something.
That's a good point. And like you say, it provides a feeling of comfort. So whether or not it actually helps you win the game, especially like again at the lower levels, it's you feel better.
Of course. It's clear that in my games, I score better when I get an opening that I know good and that I like simply. It makes clearly a difference.
So what? Speaking of what people should do to improve. Aside from openings, what advice do you find yourself giving to the young players and the students that you work with? What do you think the best way to use one's study time is?
Usually, I tell them that they need to be absolutely a killer at tactics. So they had to be very strong and very... very quick in for the calculation of variations, and this is probably the main thing for the youngster. Too many games are decided on tactics, so they have to be just to be flawless in this era. And also simply the main end game, because I always used to tell them that when they calculate something in the endgame, if they get a position they can't assess, which is quite simple. We are speaking about maybe recently one of my students who is 2200. He told me, I was fighting for a draw. I could get this endgame with a rook and 2 pawns versus a rook and 3 pawns on the same part of the board on the king side, and he told me, but I didn't know if it was a draw or if it was maybe winning for him. I didn't want to suffer, and I told him this kind of things you need to know for sure. So we did some work on the rook end games. It seemed to me too obvious to miss these things. You need to assess precisely your position. Maybe you don't know precisely how to play it, but you need to assess it without any calculation.
Yeah. So what resources do you recommend for people who need to improve such aspects of their game?
There are some pretty good books. I think for the end games, the books is still the best way because it's not so easy to get something if you just look at the recent games where there were some endgames. Sometimes it's just too complicated. When you see a game of Magnus, okay, it's well played, but if you can't do the same, then you basically learn nothing. So I think the books are the best for the endgames.
Books in particular?
I grew up with the book of Dvoretsky and Manual of Endgame. And I still think it's one of the best, but there is this one of Jeremy Silman, which is quite interesting. And also, I think a book of Glenn Fleer about practical play in the endgame.
Sorry, who is the author?
Fleer. Glenn Fleer.
Okay. And English, do you have a sense? Writer. So the Dvoretsky book obviously is for strong players, probably 2200-ish up. The Silman book is much more accessible for players of all levels. What about the Glenn Fleer book?
I think it's more or less all level because it takes opening. It takes end games where you don't really know if it's winning or not. It's like there are too many pieces. maybe there are still bishop and knight and some mini pawns, but it's practical. It means he's trying to explain every principles in the endgames, and he's not interested in the theory of endgame, where you need to know how you draw a rook endgame or something. He doesn't really care about that. He just wants to provide the people who read it some tips of how to actually play what happens in the games, actually, to be able to have some principles. And I think it's maybe the best thing, because it's one thing to be able to draw something you know, but it's only particular cases, and it's much better to have a good technique and to know how to play, more or less, how to feel the position. And it's more or less what he's trying to provide the readers.
Okay, sounds good. And for tactics?
For tactics, I think there are some books. The books of Romain Edouard are quite good. I mean,
they're recommended all the time, so we can't just say that you're just trying to pump your friend's work.
No, they are, well renowned, so I think they're quite good. But also, even starting with the website providing this kind of things, I think on Lichess or chess.com you can work on tactics. But the problem with the websites is generally the players do it wrong. It's like they see a move, it's like the obvious sacrifice, for example, and they just want to play it, and then they are waiting for black answer, and maybe it's not even working, but at least they're playing without much thought, and this is not really helpful. So what I used to say is that if you do this on the website, if you find the move, the obvious move, but if you're the move of the opponent you didn't notice, you didn't think about it, then you just didn't really understand the thing, because it means that you didn't calculate the best way for black to play.
It's so easy to just click when you're doing the online trainers.
I think, but if you manage to just do it properly and just think to every variations beforehand, then it might be helpful for sure.
Okay, excellent advice. Do you have any particular, so Romain's books, do you know of any tactics books for less advanced players?
I think there is a book I'm using of Csaba Balog. I think it's called something like 556 puzzles. I think it's something like this. There is a strange number. And there are examples of many levels from easy to difficult, and I know it's quite good as well, but I know there are many tactic books for every level, so Romain's books are more for, already advanced player, but there are also tactics for, even beginners, so you can find everything.
Okay. All right, and Adrian, last topic, if you're up for it. I just wanted to talk about your globetrotting, your travels, and growing up in Tahiti. Was there chess in Tahiti? Were you already competing a lot when you lived there?
I think every kind of islands more or less have the same problem. So I started to play chess in Tahiti when I was 7 with my father. Then I liked it, so he brought me to a club. There were 2 clubs in Tahiti Island. And the main thing is, the main problem is there are only a few strong opponents. And also you always used to play the same. It's like when I was little, I think the best players were around 1700, something like this. So I reached 1600 quite fast, maybe at 9 or 10 years old. And then you can't really make progress because if you don't have people clearly stronger than you, then it's mainly impossible to make progress to get to know what's good or what's not. If the advice you get are simply wrong, then you can't take any good of it. So yeah, I think it's a main problem. And recently they are trying to develop in Tahiti chess in schools, so the same as in Corsica, and yeah, the results is quite satisfying because every child in Tahiti has to play chess in school. Every child.
Oh wow, that's awesome!
And so that makes maybe, I'm not sure, but around probably 20,000. It's not so little number. I think 20,000 child are taught chess at least 1 year in their courses. So yeah, it's a big achievement. But the other problem is, even if you manage to find a particularly strong child, a gifted child, then it's quite hard because there is no proper tournament. So if he wants to play, he has to go back to France, but it's very far.
Yeah.
Or he has to go to maybe New Zealand or Australia, which are the closest countries, but he needs to speak English. And it's already maybe 6 or 7 hours of plane. So yeah, it's quite complicated to manage to play tournaments.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, I've never been to Tahiti, but it looks so beautiful. It seems like it would be hard to focus on chess in like a tropical paradise.
Yeah, it's difficult, but okay. You can just spend all day at the beach. So yeah. You need to do something else at some point.
I suppose. And you can bring your chess books to the beach too. So
of course.
So, and then you've also, I saw you played in Australia, you played in New Zealand. So is that all these sort of, not these distant places from France, is that because of the time you spent in Tahiti that you choose to play there, or are you just trying to see as many places as you can?
Yeah, it's probably because I grew up far from France. I like to travel, so with chess, the good thing is you can manage to find tournaments in every part of the world. So when I have, as a grandmaster, when I have an offer to play somewhere where I'm interested to go, then I, in general, if I have time, I take time to go. So yeah, I went twice in Australia, I went to New Zealand, in many parts of Europe, of course, and I played in the US also. I'm trying to play in many different parts of the world.
And what's your favorite place that you've played?
Actually, it's
or
probably,
coached, I should say.
No, I think it's probably Australia because the country is so fascinating, and they are trying to hold some strong tournaments. They are doing some Grandmaster Norm tournaments and some very strong Opens. And yeah, the places is very nice to visit. The people are really cool. And I think I will get back there.
Yeah, I've been once. I would love to go back someday. Yeah. And what else outside of chess? Do you what other interests do you have?
Mainly the films. So I mean, cinemas and series. I actually spend too much time in watching movies and yeah. This is probably my main interest right now.
Do you have like a type of movie that you're into?
It can be many types of movies, but so from superheroes movies to some historic movies, I don't really, as long as the story is entertaining, I'm quite happy to see it. And speaking of which, there is in France, in French language, there is a new film about chess that is pretty interesting. Probably the best film movie about chess that I managed
excellent.
To see. It's called Fahim. So it's about a friend of mine. So it's a young Bangladesh player who went to France when he was 11 years old. He became a French champion while he didn't have any paper to be in France, and he managed to get the nationality out of it. And yeah, it's a really beautiful story, a real story, and the movie is really good. So people should go to see it. And in France, it's quite a big success.
That's great. So hopefully that filters through to more interest in chess generally. Certainly, some movies have had that that effect in the past. Yeah, I'll look into. So it looks like it's called Fahim, the Little Chess Prince in English.
Yes. There are some good actors, pretty well-known actors.
Awesome. So yeah, Gerard Depardieu. We'll look into when it's making its way into English with subtitles, but that sounds awesome. Okay. Last thing. So what's up for you the rest of the year? Do you have any coaching or playing obligations lined up?
I'm going to play some tournaments. So I'm heading to Malta Island in a few days.
Oh wow! You know how to pick your destinations.
Yes, I don't know this one, so I will discover Malta and play the Open that starts in 10 days, and probably the Roma Open in December.
Okay, sounds good to me.
Interesting.
Well, Adrian, congrats on your successes with your books, and obviously in the looking ahead to the French Championship next year. Is there a way for people to keep up with what you're doing? Are you on any social media, or do you want to? I don't know if you want to share your email address or what, but
yeah, I am on Facebook, so it's the easiest way to follow me. But I'm not a public person, so I don't share that much, at least.
Okay,
but I'm still on Facebook, and there are some things that I'm publishing.
Okay, and obviously, if you're talking with Romain, people can keep an eye on what's happening with Thinkers Publishing. Hopefully, you guys can come up with another project. But in the meantime, there's plenty to go through with the Modernized Ready, the Modernized Dutch Defense, and, of course, your London System course on Chess24, which all due respect, but the fact that you said that the London System is less work, if I have to pick one, I think that's that's the one I'd go with.
That's my advice.
Okay, excellent. All right, well, Adrian, have a good day and continued successes.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Special thanks, as always, to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank everyone who helped spread the word about Perpetual Chess. The ways to do so include writing a positive review on Apple Podcasts or another podcast platform, telling a friend, spreading the word on social media. All of that stuff helps. But most of all, I want to thank the people who support the show financially. Without you guys, Perpetual Chess would not be possible. So I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities, my PayPal and Patreon Perpetual Chess partners. Here we go. They are extra special thanks to Chessable.com and Quality Chess Books and the Capital City Chess Club, Apprend Chess Twitch channel, Andrew Bach, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porto, Kathy Cow, Chad Oliver, Dan O'Hanlon, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Greg Natel, Greg Shahadi, Guvin Manet, Jens Green, John Jernigan, John Cromartie, Kelly Palmer, Lone Pine Chess, Lorraine Duray, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Michael Kahn, my main man Moonmaster 9000, Seattle Chess Club, Thomas Stonix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryan, Todd Kennedy, and I'd also like to thank Aaron Waffler, Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, FM Andre Terakov, Andrew Perry, Bill Moran, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, Chad Hilton, Chris Balcom, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Wood. I am Christoph Zalicki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Courtney Fry, David Kofor, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Lucas of U.S. Chess, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Cramley, CEO of Chessable.com, Daylin Shelton, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith, Donnie Ario, who may be an IM elect or maybe just has the titles, and I'm not sure if that makes him an IM elect, but thank you, Donnie, anyway. Fox Valley Chess Club, Frank Tortoris, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vanderveld, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Han Shu, Harish Srinivasan, James Bonastia, Jason Onfang, Jason Woolum, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, JJ Stranad, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Zlosnik, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, GM Josh Friedel, IM Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, IM Kostya Kurvutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Larry Reiforth, Laura Belyavsky, Lucio Casada Silva, Martin Knudsen, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, the Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Alerd, Miguel Araspide, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Nate Salon, Neil Bruce, Olaf Mueller Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Pasi Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Swanee, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Roy Yearwood, Ryan Berg, Scott Doherty, Scott McKinnon, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrankuj, William H. Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks a lot, everyone. I will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.